Man, last week the question was asked, how big or how wide was Israel at some point in our session? You remember that? Mm-hmm. You asked that question.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I remember that. Yeah. You probably don't. You just saying yes because I'm calling you out right now. It's all good. It's all good. And as a short answer was given about the size of New Jersey, right? You said that too, right? See? And you probably just shaking your head too because I'm wondering that, you know?
500 miles wide.
Oh, that's a little bit too wide. But as I was preparing this session, though, the Holy Spirit of God laid on me to discuss this topic just a little bit more. After all, is not Israel important to the movement of God? Mm-hmm. Oh, come on. As Israel goes, so goes the world, right?
Right.
Come on, y'all. We pretty much know Israel history from the time of Abraham to the New Testament writings based off of God's word. No doubt about it. But you ever thought about Israel's history from AD 70 to present? What happened? Show the slides, please. All right, can we get the lights? In 70 AD, Jerusalem was devastated and the temple destroyed by the Roman Emperor Titus. All right. 324 to 325 AD, the Roman Emperor Constantine officially recognizes Christianity and ends Christian persecution. Within between 70 AD, 324, 325 was called the Age of the Martyrs in church history. Next slide. After unifying the Roman Empire under his rule in 324 AD, Constantine the Great rebuilt his seat of his power in Byzantine in 330 AD, which was renamed Constantinople after him. Y'all tracking, right? The Byzantine Empire, also referred to as the Eastern Roman Empire, was the continuation of the Roman Empire in the eastern part of the Mediterranean. In 610 AD, the Temple Mount in Jerusalem becomes the central point for Muslim salat or prayers. We're rolling into the Muslims now.
Here we go.
In 614 AD, during the siege of Jerusalem, Jerusalem falls to the Muslims. In 629 AD, under the Byzantine Emperor y'all see it. I couldn't get that one out. That one didn't roll off the tongue too good, but Heracles, somebody said. All right, we'll roll with that. Jerusalem is recaptured from the Muslims. In 636 to 637 AD, the Muslims recaptured Jerusalem after a few months earlier when the Byzantine Empire was defeated. All right, so we're back under Muslim rule, right?
That's right.
Okay, next slide. Jerusalem is now under Muslim control. Construction on the Dome of the Rock, and we all know what this is, right? Was finished between 691 and 692 AD, 55 years after the Muslim armies recaptured Jerusalem. Fast forward to the Crusades. We've all heard of this, right? Europeans, Christians, and Muslims fought numerous conflicts between 1095 and 1291, which we all know as the Crusades. The Crusades were a series of religious wars aimed at recapturing the Holy Land, Jerusalem, from Islamic Muslim rule. That was the Crusades. That's in essence what it was all about. Sanctioned by the popes of the Latin Church, the Crusades also consisted of other church-authorized military campaigns. However, the Crusades failed and the Holy Land remained under the control of the Muslims. They didn't recapture it. Several reasons are given why the Crusades failed. such as failure of Eastern and Western European nations to cooperate in supporting the wars? The Crusaders had to travel long, overland route from their points of origin in Europe through the deserts and mountains of Asia Minor, which is modern-day Turkey. Once at their destination and their place of conflict, they were just very tired. The size of their armies was small in comparison to the Muslim armies, and any victories realized by the Crusaders were short-lived. And guys, this gets even better. Eventually, they just lost faith in the movement. And as we know, they were not successful. Fast forward, in 1453, when Constantinople was deteriorating through various invasions and battles, the Ottoman Turks were able to finally capture the city. 1453, the Ottoman Turks retained the name Constantinople. From 1516 to the end of World War I, the whole region of Western Asia was part of the Ottoman Empire, to include, y'all, Jerusalem. World War I brought Britain and those Arab nations who were dissatisfied with Ottoman rule into an alliance with each other. The Ottoman Turks were finally defeated. On October 30, 1918, representatives of Great Britain and the Ottoman Empire signed an armistice treaty, marking the end of the Ottoman Turks' participation in World War I. When did World War I officially end? 19 Veterans Day, to give you a hint. November the 11th, 1919. That's when the armistice was signed. It used to be called Armistice Day, right? And now it got changed to Veterans Day. With Great Britain loosely in control of the territory, here we go, y'all. Palestine was part of the Ottoman Empire and under Turkish control. In July 1922, the League of Nations entrusted Great Britain with the mandate for Palestine. Hold it there. What is the League of Nations now known as? Say it. The United Nations, absolutely. Next slide. With the historical connection of the Jewish people with Palestine, to facilitate the establishment of a Jewish national home in Palestine Eretz, also Israel, land of Israel, recognized, the objective of the Palestine mandate was to administer territorial parts of the defunct Ottoman Empire. They had to divide the land up. It gets even better. Palestine then composed land on the east of the Jordan River, north on the north by the border between modern Israel and Lebanon, on the west by the Mediterranean Sea, including the coast of Gaza. Hold the slide. This off, just off your minds, what you just see there, what land does that also encompass? No. Well, Jordan, but in particular, say it. Jerusalem or Israel. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. That whole land there is encompassing Israel. Continuing and on the south by the Negev, with its southernmost extension reaching the Gulf of Aqaba. And when you look at Israel, and as it goes down like this, it's going into the Gulf of Aqaba. The land of historical Palestine encompasses the land, like we said, Israel now calls home. In September 1922, the League of Nations and Great Britain decided that the provisions for setting up a Jewish national home would not apply to the area east of the Jordan River, which constituted 3/4 of the territory included in the mandate. So in other words, it's not including, if you look at the map of Israel, we're going to show it in a moment. If you look to the east, what country sits to the east of Israel? Jordan. The Palestinian mandate would not encompass that. This area east of the Jordan River eventually became the Kingdom of Jordan. And we know that Jordan is going to play a significant role During the tribulation, right? Absolutely. Because where is that the two-thirds of the one-third of Israel going to flee to? Petra, which is in Jordan. Absolutely. They will be supernaturally protected by God during the last half of the tribulation. The administration of the area was to be under British control until 1948. That is a critical year to keep in mind. 1948. Keep that year in mind. On July 24, 1923, the Ottoman Empire was finally dissolved. When the Republic of Turkey was founded in 1923, the capital was moved to Ankara, and Constantinople was officially renamed Istanbul. In 1930. So let me know that the Byzantine Empire was basically situated there in Asia Minor, which we now know it today as Turkey. Constantinople. In 1947, the United Nations formed the League of Nations had authorized the creation of an independent Jewish state in a portion of the occupied territories. Here we go, y'all. Here we go. Here we go. The surrounding Arab nations vowed not to allow this to happen. As the British mandate to occupy that was then called Palestine, the land Israel calls home today, was ending, war appeared imminent. The drumbeats of war was coming. On May 14, 1940, what year did I say to keep in mind? United Nations Resolution 181 went into effect, creating the sovereign nation of Israel from the former British Mandate of Palestine. Many theologians view this as a prophecy fulfilled. You can look at it in Isaiah chapter 68, verse 8. On May 15, 1948, five Arab nations invaded. A day after. But Israel defended itself, losing only the Gaza Strip to Egypt and the West Bank of the Jordan River, including the old city of Jerusalem to Jordan. But keep that in mind, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank. For the next 19 years, Israel fought multiple conflicts with its neighbors over its right to exist. They still doing that today, ain't they? During this time, the U.S. grew concerned about increasing Soviet power and influence in the Arab states and began to arm Israel. They started. In the May 1967 speech, Egyptian leader Gamal Nasser declared his intention to unify the Arab nations and to defeat Israel. He then expelled U.N. peacekeepers that had been there in the Sinai since the July 1956 Suez Crisis. Nasser then moved tens of thousands of men, tanks, and artillery to his border with Israel the following day. 3 days later, on May 22, he blockaded all ships bound for Israel through the Straits of Tehran. What year is this? 1967. That's another significant year that you need to keep in mind, right? The Arab nations were united in this purpose, single purpose, to destroy the nation Israel. And over the next 10 days, in May, June of 1967, nearly 250,000 Arab troops marched towards Israel. Y'all, that's a lot of people. That's a lot of people. That's 250,000. That's a lot of people. Oil producers nations agreed to boycott any nation that defended Israel. Disregarding U.S. pleas to wait. Because at this time, America had really pressed Israel not to do anything, but to wait. Israel said no. And they could not wait any longer, and they launched a surprise attack. Mm-hmm. On June 5, 1967, Israel launched a surprise attack on Egypt's Air Force, crippling the largest and most modern of the Arab fleets at that time, while simultaneously launching an attack against Egyptian troops. They sure did. Within just 4 days, the Egyptian, Syrian, and Jordanian armies were overwhelmingly defeated. Israel captured, what did I say focus on? The West Bank from Jordan and the Gaza Strip, right? And the Sinai Peninsula from Egypt and the Golan Heights from Syria. We got a map here in a minute. Israel regained control of East Jerusalem, reuniting Jerusalem as one city. We know this as the what? The Six-Day War of 1967. We all know that. We all know that. Yes, he was. Like I said, when God decides to flex his muscle, watch out. The history of the Israeli-Palestine-Arab conflict began, one can loosely say, started with the League of Nations Palestine Mandate in 1922. And then erupted into full-scale armed conflict with the establishment of the State of Israel in 1948, and they've been fighting ever since then. It does seem like it, don't it? Palestinian refugees are people who lost both their homes and means of livelihood as a result of the Arab-Israeli conflict and the 1967 Six-Day War. Next slide. At the heart of the Israel-Palestine-Arab conflict today lies the question of the Palestine territories occupied by Israel since the 1967 Six-Day War, which includes the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem today. So here we go. Can y'all see that? So here's the Golan. Here's Syria. There's Lebanon. Here's the Mediterranean. Here's Egypt. And this part right here is the Sinai. That's what they had captured. Right here, as I said here, going down through here is the Gulf of Aqaba, because here's Saudi Arabia. There's Jordan. Here's the West Bank. There's East Jerusalem here. Here is the Gaza Strip. These are the occupied territories. And there's the Golan Heights. Right there. That's what Israel recaptured. But they gave some of it back. They gave the Golan Heights back to Israel. I'm sorry, back to Syria. Here's the West Bank. Israel says here, in 1981, is annexation not internationally recognized by Israel, the Golan Heights. Here is the Gaza Strip, and here are the occupied territories. These are Palestinian controlled. It says here on the map here that the Golan Heights is actually controlled by Israel there, it says. And it still is today. So I misspoke on that. Excuse me. How big is the Gaza Strip? That's not big at all. Well, it's less than 50 miles because there's a scale. So if you put that scale over here, it's less than 50 miles for sure. For sure. It is sandy.
The importance of the Gaza Strip. The other parts I can see, but the Gaza Strip is a little bit of a geeky thing.
Because this, he said, what's the importance of the Gaza Strip? That's because that this is land that the Palestinians recognize as theirs. And so Israel is saying it's occupied territory. It's Palestinian controlled. Yes, it is. And but then they're saying that this is theirs, along with all of this here. And this is all, this is the conflict that's going on, is that basically whose land is it?
That's right.
It's Israel.
We know it's Israel's, absolutely. That's right. God has already said that it's Israel's.
They have the deed on it.
They got the deed way back in, what, Genesis chapter, what, 12, 15, in that neighborhood? They got the deed.
Israel was originally a lot bigger than that, right?
The question was Israel a lot bigger than this? Not necessarily. You had to, before it was like really Israel,
So
when you're talking about with the King David's time, yeah, you did have some land over in this area here. But remember, during the Palestinian Mandate, they had part of that. Remember, all of this was part of all of the Ottoman Turks. They controlled all of this, to include Asia Minor that's way up in this area here. But from here, during the Palestinian Mandate, that's when they began to, under British control, until from 1922 to 1948, that's when it was decided to section off a portion of the land to say, hey, okay, this land right here, former Palestine, is for the modern state of Israel, with the exception of, here's the Jordan River, except east of that, which would belong to the Kingdom of Jordan.
So because Israel was gone for all those years up until 1948.
Israel was never gone.
Well, no,
they just didn't control it.
The Palestine people thought that it was theirs because they were in there. I mean, the Jews were not there. Right?
The Jews were there. They were there. The issue is not that the Jews were not there. The issue is who controlled the land. Mm. That was the issue.
But to this day, the Palestine people think it's theirs.
Yeah. But remember, during the Six-Day War, Israel captured this land, and they also captured the Sinai here, but they gave it back.
Yeah.
And the Golan Heights, which I misspoke earlier, is still under their control, but it was part of Syria there. But Israel controls it. I see a hand.
I just have an interesting aside on the Golan.
You have a who?
An interesting little anecdote on the Golan Heights. Mm-hmm. Back in those days, Israel had a mole in Damascus, which is a secret spy in the government. And the mole would, of course, inform them of all their plans for conquest. But that mole also was greatly responsible for them getting the Golan Heights there at that time, because he suggested that they plant trees around all of the ditches, rather the places for their fortifications where they were shooting down on the Israelis. He suggested, why don't you plant trees so our soldiers can be comfortable, et cetera, et cetera. So they planted all these trees that outlined where all the fortifications or the underground fortifications were for the Syrians and other. So they knew exactly where to bomb. Israel knew exactly where to bomb. And so it was really something to find out.
There's another tidbit on that. I think it was during the 1967, during the Six-Day War. There was an open area, and I heard this guy talk about it on TBN one day, and he was saying how Israel was going to try to walk across the land, but something told them to stop, and it was at nighttime, so they stopped. And so a fierce wind came, sandstorm came through. And then in the next day, what was revealed was the whole area was covered by landmines.
Oh, wow.
Yep, absolutely.
They knew it was a minefield, though. They found it, and they were digging it, and as they were doing it, the wind came.
Absolutely. They didn't know where it was. I mean, they didn't. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Wow. Now, is it wall?
Is what wall? There are some walls here.
Okay, yeah. Just around here.
Just for control, you know, of course, to control
okay.
entry and exit.
All right.
But yeah, there are some walls here.
Okay.
Okay. I think we're almost done. Israel has a current population of somewhere between 8.5 and 9.1 million, depending on where you research. According to Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs website, and I went to their website, it is 8,630 square miles in total land area, the aggregate. 290 miles in length, 85 miles in width at its widest point, 9 miles wide at its narrowest point. 290 miles in length. According to the Israel's Ministry of Foreign Affairs website. No, it's about the size of New Jersey, roughly. It is, when you research and you say how big is Israel, one of the things that pops up and says it's about the size of New Jersey. I think that's the last one. Is that the last one? Are we good?
Yes. Thank you.
Great.
Yeah.
Get to
that was good work.
But somebody say something?
Well, to fit 9 million people in a 290-mile, that's pretty, it seems like it would be pretty crowded, but they have a lot of farms.
It's a lot of land.
A lot of, I guess you're right. Mm-hmm. 8,000 square miles.
Especially the land of Megiddo, where Armageddon is going to occur, up in the northwest of Jerusalem. It's been said that Napoleon called that the world's most natural battlefield.
Yeah.
Because it's just so flat. And you figure a 250 million man army, at least at a minimum, is going to be there during the Battle of Armageddon, when the time of Christ returns. Fascinating. Yeah. Absolutely fascinating. Thank you. All right, verses 1 through 2, chapter 6. Are we good?
Yeah.
We good?
Now we are.
We good? All right. Sorry about the Golan Heights thing. I stand corrected, so I appreciate that. All right, chapter 6, verses 1 through 2. Again, King David gathered all the 30 choice men of Israel, 30,000, and David arose and went with all the people who were with him from Baal Judah to bring up from there the ark of God, whose name is called by the name the Lord of hosts, who dwells between the cherubims. I appreciate y'all correcting me, because one thing I learned is that sometimes when you talk a lot in front of people, sometimes you misspeak. You do? And I tell you, man, I've done it sometimes. I've misquoted some scripture. I went home and I've just felt so bad. And I couldn't wait to get here next week to correct myself. But I tell you, man, but I do appreciate that. So thank all of you for that. I do appreciate it. In verse 1, King David has gathered 30,000 choice men, or to say it another way, he handpicked these men out of his army. 1 Chronicles chapter 13, verse 1 tells us that King David consulted with his captains of thousands and hundreds, with every leader. And before we continue, let's backstep just a brief moment to set the scene, Bible students. King David and Israel have defeated the Philistines. Not once, but how many times? Two? Right. Absolutely. Twice. After their victory, they've reconstituted back to Jerusalem and celebrated with a huge feast. All right? Y'all tracking? As we do not know how much time has lapsed between returning to Jerusalem, their feast celebrations, and here in verse 1, things must have calmed, or they are at rest after their victory in battle. Israel has reconstituted so that now King David consulted with his captains and his leaders to handpick 30,000 men for this special mission. What's this special mission? Go get the ark. Absolutely. Absolutely. 1 Chronicles chapter 13, verses 2 through 5. 1 Chronicles 13, 2 through 5. And David said to all the assembly of Israel, "If it seems good to you, and if it is of the Lord our God, let us send out to our brethren, everyone who are left in all the land of Israel, and with them to the priests and Levites who are in their cities and their common lands, that they may gather together to us, and let us bring the ark of our God back to us. For we have not inquired at it since the days of Saul." Then all the assembly said that they would do so, for the thing was right in the eyes of all the people. Verse 5. So David gathered all Israel together from Shihor in Egypt to as far as the entrance of Hamath to bring the ark of God from Kirjath-Jearim. They are now set to retrieve the ark of the covenant. They're ready. So vital is the Ark of the Covenant to Israel and the Old Testament writers. Let's spend a few moments talking about it. The Ark of the Covenant has different names in God's Word. Of course, it's called the Ark of the Covenant in Numbers chapter 10, verse 33. It's called the Ark of the Testimony, Exodus chapter 30, verse 6. It's the Ark of the Lord in Joshua chapter 4, verse 11. It is the Ark of God in 1 Samuel chapter 3, verse 3. It is the Ark of God's strength in 2 Chronicles chapter 6, verse 41. God gave details instructions for its construction in Exodus chapter 25, verses 10 through 22. God gave precise instructions on how it was to be built. The ark was made of shittim wood or acacia wood in Exodus chapter 25, verse 10 and chapter 37, verse 1. If you read the Old King James Version, it says acacia. The New King James says shittim. The Old King James says acacia. Shittim wood was known to the Egyptians as a tree of life and was an important plant in traditional medicine. The ark was covered with the purest gold, and the mercy seat was surrounded with a rim of gold. On each side, there were two gold rings where two wooden poles overlaid with gold were inserted to carry the ark. I want y'all to focus on those three words. Carry the ark. Focus on that. I want y'all to keep that in mind as we move forward. To carry the ark, and then you think about Uzzah. Over the ark were two cherubims with their faces and their wings, outstretched wings towards each other. So if you had the mercy, if the mercy seat was here, if an angel, if the cherubim was here, and this was a cherubim, they would be like this over the mercy seat. God resided over the mercy seat where he met with Moses. Exodus chapter 25 verses 21 through 22 and Leviticus chapter 16 verses 1 through 2. How we doing? We doing good? Yes, we good? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. The ark, back one please. I forgot number 9. Yes, thank you. The ark was placed in the most holy place or the holy of holies in the tabernacle. I want y'all to focus on that. What separated the most holy place from the holy of holies? A what? A veil, right? Focus. I want y'all to key in on that. Key in on veil, because they were supposed to do something with that veil. They were supposed to do something with that veil that they did not do. Focus again on Uzzah. The tribe of Levi were the only tribe that was allowed to keep the ark in the tabernacle of the testimony. Numbers chapter 1, verse 47 through 53. Chapter 3, verse 6 through 9. And the first 26 verses of Numbers chapter 8. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 4 says the ark contained three items. The golden pot of manna signifying how the Lord sustained Israel with manna for 40 years until their arrival at the borders of Canaan, the promised land. Exodus 16, 33 through 35. Hold it there.
The budding rod.
Okay. We're not there yet, but you're right. You're right. You're absolutely correct, though. No, you're right. The budding rod. But I want to stop here because the manna. All right. How many years did God supply them with manna? 40 years. God gave them only enough to sustain them for the day. But over the weekend, what did he say? He gave them enough to cover it in the weekend. But what would happen if they got too much? It rotted, right? God sustains us. He gives us what we need. He does. And sometimes if we get too much, watch out, somebody. Can rot, but not only rot, but it can also, think about it, sometimes too much of that material possessions can begin to corrupt us on the inside, right? And then it can rot us, right? Oh, come on, somebody get that in a minute, man. Somebody get it. Come on, just show the next slide. The tables of testimony or the Ten Commandments signifying the law of God that is to be followed. Exodus 25, verse 16. Question, was this the first or the second set of the tables of testimony?
Second.
What happened to the first?
He broke it.
When did he break it? Came down and saw the people doing what? Worshiping the calf, golden calf, right? Come up, what did Aaron do? I don't know. I just threw the gold in and poof, popped out this calf. Come on, Aaron. Really? Come on, man. I just threw it in the fire and poof, popped out this calf. Yeah, right. Come on, Aaron. And Aaron was the older brother. Yeah, he should have known better. Peer pressure? All right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he was. They made him a priest. God showed mercy on him. Because God could have wiped him out. And we know what happened. Moses got mad, and what did he say? Who's on the Lord's side? Who was the only tribe that showed up?
Levi,
the tribe of Levi. Who's also of the tribe of Levi? Moses and Aaron and Miriam, their sister. Absolutely. They went through the camp and slew about 3,000 men. From that day forward, God said, the Levi tribe of Levi will be a special inheritance for me. Amen. They will be the only ones who would have the distinct honor of caring for the ark and the tabernacle.
Can you just imagine how Aaron felt when he did the poof and the calf come out, and then he immediately go to the Lord's side.
Yeah.
I messed up, boy.
He did. I just can imagine what it looked like when he was telling the story to Moses. The last thing is Aaron's rod that budded, signifying the judgment of God on those who are disobedient to him and his word. Numbers chapter 17, verses 5 through 10. It says that in Numbers 17, 5 through 10. And that's basically what the ark would look like. Can you imagine back in the day what all the tabernacle and all of that just looked like? Looking at gold in its purest form back in the day, can you just imagine that?
I bet it weighed a lot.
Well, it may have weighed quite a bit.
With all that gold on it?
Mm-hmm. But like I said, I want y'all to focus on the poles. All right? Focus on the poles, and I want y'all to focus on the veil. And I want y'all to keep Uzzah in mind. All right? All right, in verse 2, continuing on in our scriptural text, we see here King David and his 30,000 chosen men go to Baal Judah to bring up the ark to carry it back to Israel. We're going to talk more about that in a moment. Key in on verse 2, back on the screen, please, Mr. Trevor. How the ark of God, whose name is called the name of the Lord of hosts. Interestingly, some translations may say the Lord Almighty or El Shaddai in some translations. But I throw this at you. In the King James Version, in the Old King James Version, and also, or should I say the New King James Version, they have the Lord of Hosts, or Yahweh Sabaoth, which is the Lord of Hosts, or the Lord of the armies. That's what it is. Signifying how he, God, fights our battles and is the ultimate victor who dwells between the cherubim. Cherubim is singular or plural, Bible students?
Plural.
It is the plural of what root word? Cherub. Cherub has how many wings, Bible students?
Four. No, six.
How many wings they have? They have six. Remember, Lucifer was an anointed what? Because it says with the seraphims, remember. I'm sorry. Wait a minute. Let's back up. Let's back up. Cherubs have how many wings? Cherubs has four wings. The seraphims has six wings. All right. Remember, with two, they do what?
Two, they fly. Two, they cover themselves. Two, they cover themselves.
There you go.
Yeah.
The seraphims has six wings. Cherubs has four wings. Lucifer was an anointed what?
Cherub.
Absolutely. He has, a cherub. What did I just say? Cherub has how many wings?
Four.
Seraphims has how many?
Six.
There you go. Cherub has how many wings?
Four.
The seraphims has how many wings?
Six.
All right. In teaching, you tell them again, and you tell them again what you just told them. And then you tell them again. Because they'll forget it next week. All right. Here we go. So now the question, how did the Ark of the Covenant get here? How did it get here? And if y'all don't believe me about the seraphims, y'all got Google, just Google it. And it'll tell you. Seraphims has six wings. Am I right? Yeah, I'm right. Yeah, I'm right about it. Google it. You can Google it and find the six wings. How many wings does a cherub seraphim have? Six. Oh my goodness gracious, man. Oh my goodness, here we go. Oh my goodness. Y'all something else, man. Y'all something else. Y'all pitiful, you know that? I'm telling my wife, she always asks me, how was Bible study? I'm saying, man, they pitiful, but I get it. All right. So the question is, how did the ark get here? How did it get to Baal Judah? It was captured in a battle by the Philistines. No, that's fine. No, I'll receive that. Look, please tell me. If you got something to say, say it. This is Bible study, right? So I've got captured in the battle with the Philistines. Okay, I got a motion. We just had the thing on Sunday. You motion it? You second it? All right, all in favor? Aye. All opposed?
You're in deep trouble.
All right. Mr. Cameron looking deep in that phone there. He must have looked and said the seraphims had six. How many wings? All right. But to answer that, we got to go back several decades to 1 Samuel chapter 4. Okay? The Philistines had captured the Ark of the Covenant when they defeated Israel. Okay? In 1 Samuel chapter 5 now, after a series of severe calamities afflicting the Philistines, they decide to return the Ark of the Covenant to Israel. How many months did it stay with the Philistines? I'll give you a hint.
Eight.
Oh,
seven months. 7 months. In 1 Samuel chapter 6, after 7 months, after 7 months of severe affliction, the Ark of the Covenant makes its way to Israel by way of a carriage, by being pulled by two oxen. It made its way to Beth Shemesh in the tribal region of Dan, slightly north southwest of Kirjath-Jearim. The men of Beth Shemesh see it, and the Levites removed the Ark of the Covenant from the wagon, where burnt offerings and sacrifices were made that day. However, because the men of Beth Shemesh looked inside the ark, remember now, they looked inside the ark, the men of Beth Shemesh, when the oxen driving the ark got there. The Philistines followed it, actually, and made sure that it got to where it got to, and then they went back home. The men of Beth Shemesh see the oxen driving the cart that has the ark on the back of it. They grab it. They look at it. They offer burnt offerings and sacrifices. They then look inside of it, and guess what happens? They got destroyed. Y'all remember the Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark when they opened it up? All right. So God struck down, but guess how many he struck? 50,000 men he struck. Just from opening up the ark. But you got to remember, why did he do that? Because look, who were the only ones who were supposed to divinely touch the ark? The Levites. Absolutely. Absolutely. They broke God's divine way of carrying the ark. And we're going to talk about that. Keep that in mind. And we're almost done. It represents the holiness of God. God said that no man can look on him and live. Remember, what did Moses say? God, I'm doing all this for you. Please show me your glory. He said in Exodus, show me your glory. I think it was Exodus, number one of them. So God said, no man has seen me and lived. He said, but I will do this for you. I'll put you in the cleft of a rock in a mountain. I will pass by you, and my hand will cover your face, and then I will remove it so that you can see my backside. And showed it. He did turn white. He did. He got, I guess you could say, sunburnt in the modern vernacular, right? He sure did. But that's a part of the glory of God that he saw. But guess what, Christian? You being a child of God, when you get on the other side of glory, guess who you gonna see? Oh, come on, somebody. Y'all will get that in a minute. Man, I know y'all a little slow tonight, but somebody going to get it. Oh, tomorrow. Oh, I got it. Yeah, that's what he was talking about. Tomorrow, half day through the work day, and you're, oh, I got it now. That's what he's talking about. In 1 Samuel chapter 7, the men of Beth-Shemesh, I got to end it here almost, sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kadesh-Jearim who came and took the ark and brought it into the house of Abinadab. But then they consecrated Eleazar, his son, to keep the ark. And the ark stayed in the house of Abinadab for how many years, Bible students? How many years? I give y'all a hint. 20 years. It stayed there for 20 years. In the house of Abinadab. It stayed there. Fast forward to where we are now at in verse 2. How do we reconcile the name Baal Judah, where the ark appears to be now located? Baal Judah is another name, Bible students, for Kadesh-Jearim. How do we know that? Joshua chapter 15, verse 9. 1 Chronicles chapter 13, verse 6. And this is a good place to stop for tonight.
I want to hear about what happened, why it was, and what was wrong with the veil. You got my curiosity beat. You said they done something wrong with the veil.
You got to focus on the veil, because remember, the veil separated the holy place from the most holy place.
Right.
All right. How many times could the priest go in there? How many times? Once a year, right? It's called what? Yom Kippur, absolutely. Or the Day of Atonement. There you go, Bible students. All right, y'all learning, man. There you go. There you go. There you go. What happened to the veil? You're going to have to wait till next week.